Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Jay Fox will speak with an expert about how police apprenticeship programs can help address officer recruitment issues. Also, Jay will discuss the vital role that farmers markets play in our community with a representative from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective, here's Jay Fox.
The Columbus Police Department employs over 1,800 officers and 300 civilian employees. It is the largest law enforcement agency in Ohio and fifth largest in the country. But the department has a problem: recruitment of new officers. The department has had multiple officer-involved shootings, accusations of excessive violence, and a growing overall public distrust in recent years. Joining us now is Robert Lehrman, an Institute Fellow with the Center on Labor, Human Services, and Population at the Urban Institute. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Robert, why in Columbus, in the state of Ohio, and even nationwide, are there so many police vacancies right now?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know the full answer. I guess the problem is that police jobs have always been in high demand for by people, but recently the reputation of police, the demeaning of police, has been must have deterred a lot of people. But I don't know the exact reason. I do know that there are solutions.
So why do you think it's so difficult for departments to recruit new officers?
Well, first of all, it takes a long time and it costs a lot of money to recruit. Often they've drawn on people who've been in the military, and perhaps it's just not considered such a desirable job anymore. But as I say, I don't know the full reason, but it's not uncommon and it's not unique to Columbus.
What constitutes a police apprenticeship? And how is it valuable to the department that allows those internships or apprenticeships?
Yeah. Well, first, let me clarify. Apprenticeships are not internships. They're internships tend to be short, tend to be not aimed at a full training. They're often unpaid. But apprenticeships are paid. They're learning on the job. With some coursework. And what we're proposing is that we recruit people, young people, either soon after high school or even starting perhaps toward the end of high school, where there are a lot of people interested in becoming police officers, many of whom may have taken a career technical education class in criminal justice, and so they've even gotten a start on what it means to be out there enforcing the law. And what we believe is that this group would be a great pool to draw upon, and that We think, you know, based on the experience in other in various cities, that there are a lot of young people who are looking for a good job, and we believe that this is the best way to recruit and train. The recruitment is much shorter because people have had fewer years to test their background. But, you know, there are, you know, it does still take a few months to vet applicants. They take lie detector tests. They, they do background checks. But again, the background is much shorter for someone just coming out of high school.
What is the minimum age that the apprentice has to be to qualify for a program like this?
Usually 18. In a lot of states, you can't be hired as a police officer until the age of 21. And that three-year period is where the apprenticeship takes hold. And the great thing about that three-year period is that the department has a chance to observe people over a long period. And if someone does something not appropriate, they can and continues to do things that are not appropriate, they can simply decide not to offer them a job as a police officer. But they, before they become a full police officer and responsible for arresting people and so on, they have a three-year window. The second thing is that during this window, they're doing productive work within the department and gaining experience in all kinds of activities, from the trail of evidence to fingerprinting to the interrogation techniques and so on. So the apprentices really learn in depth and in a real setting what police work is all about.
Is there any liability for the department to have an apprenticeship program?
No, there's no extra liability. I mean, you know, when you hire policemen, as you mentioned, there have been cases where, unfortunately, police engage in inappropriate behavior, and that can be very costly to departments. If we were to just reduce the risk of those bad incidents, that alone would save a lot of money. We don't count that in our estimates of costs and benefits. But no, there's no special liability beyond the standard liability of having anybody in the department.
Now, you had mentioned earlier that there was one particular market, I think in Virginia, that has successfully implemented this program. How has it helped their numbers?
Well, it hasn't helped their numbers that much because they haven't done it at scale. They don't really have that big a problem recruiting in Fairfax County. The program is successful in that the apprentices do lots of work for the department that otherwise the department would have to pay civilian employees to do. And they end up with, let's say, out of a cohort of 10 or 12, they end up with probably 10 who actually enter the role of full police officers with, again, much, much longer field-based training than officers would get through a police academy approach. The police academy approach, on average, there's about 500 hours, which is about 12, 13 weeks of field training, and in some cases, less than that, whereas the police apprentice, not all of it is in the field, but is undertaking experiences for 3 years. And much longer period of field training.
So this apprenticeship program could be used by city police departments and also county sheriff's departments as well, correct?
Absolutely. And now, in some cases where there are standalone academies, you know, you're paying for some of this activity. You could reduce the number of teachers and so on. But in other cases, the training, the academy courses take place in community colleges. And you see the apprentices, again, if they've taken a criminal justice class in high school, or they don't need to sit through anything like the whole academy period, because they've already had a lot of this material. They do sit through some of it, and some of it is still necessary, but far less than what a regular academy-trained officer would get.
We want to thank Robert Lerman from the Urban Institute for joining us today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
There are 312 farmers markets in the state of Ohio. 13 of them are right here in Columbus and play a vital role in our community. The week of August 4th to the 10th was Columbus and National Farmers Market Week, which celebrated the impact that these markets make in delivering fresh produce to our community. Joining us now is Jenny Lester Moffitt. She is the United States Department of Agriculture Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs, and as an honor, the first woman to hold that position. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on the show with you, Jay.
So what is the USDA doing to support National Farmers Market Week?
Yeah, as you mentioned, Ohio is celebrating National Farmers Market Week. This is actually the 25th year that we have had Farmers Market Week as a celebration. It's a big annual celebration that highlights the important role that farmers are playing in our nation's food system, that farmers markets play in our supporting small and local farmers and ranchers and local food businesses. There are so many really important contributions that farmers market plays in our community, enhancing the local food economy, building local regional food development, and of course, supporting American agriculture.
I remember growing up as a child in Ohio, it was the individual farmer that had the individual stand. And it wasn't until I was older that they kind of coalesced into a market. How does working with other farmers help to support the entire cause?
Yeah, you know, that's a great point. And Jay, I was at my local farmers market last weekend and talking with some of their producers, and they were talking about exactly that, how they work together. And they are, you know, different producers are at different markets, and just really collaborating so that they're not bumping into each other or competing with each other, because, you know, they are all about really supporting each other and supporting markets. And I think that's a really critical thing. So, yeah, what I love about farmers markets is there are small markets. I was able to go to a farmers market a couple years ago in Philadelphia. And some of the lower income areas where they didn't have access to local food, they were creating these small pop-up farmers markets that would happen twice a week with just like one pop-up tent and a table. And a couple farmers were bringing their product to the market. To, of course, we have markets, as you're talking about, where a whole group of farmers are coming together and bringing their product to one market. And when we do that, when we organize farmers markets in that way, we bring more consumers. People know when they can come and they can go and they can buy products. And they know that there are going to be so many different options at the market as well with all the different producers there.
In the state of Ohio this year, the SNAP program, which provides benefits for low-income families, has started to double the value and offer more opportunity for low-income families to acquire, purchase produce specifically. Is that something that is a trend across the nation, or is it just an Ohio thing?
It is absolutely a trend across the nation. And what I, farmers markets, so we have 8,000 farmers markets around the country, and close to half of them, 3,400, are SNAP authorized farmers markets. And as you talked about, the programs like Double Up Food Bucks are really important as well as to really to further provide funding for consumers, particularly low income consumers, as well as seniors, to be able to have better access to produce, to locally grown food, and to be able to use those not just at their grocery store, but also at farmers markets.
Now, we love going to the grocery store, but we love going to farmers markets as well. How long is the produce at the grocery store in terms of age? How old is it versus a farmers market? Is a farmers market fresher, or is that not necessarily the case?
You know, I don't have data on that, but I would say that, you know, a farmer that is selling their product at the market, oftentimes when I'm talking with farmers, they have sometimes harvested that product that morning or just the day before. And you can taste the great flavor when you get that freshly harvested tomato or strawberry or what have you. It just tastes so delicious and wonderful when it's fresh picked from the farm. It also, I think, tastes really wonderful when you get a chance to talk with a farmer about what they grow, why they grow it, about the family that is producing that food. And it just brings that connectivity that I think so many of us seek to really further connect with how our food is grown.
How important is food education to this process? A lot of low-income families are simply not aware of the benefits of produce, fresh vegetables, fresh fruits, and they're also not aware of where they can get them and perhaps may perceive them as not able to be afforded.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, nutrition education is really, really important. And I know so many markets do actually provide nutrition education, not just in, you know, how do we select produce, right? So also what's becoming more and more prevalent are what we call produce prescriptions. So doctors talking about how nutrition is a really important part of our health, but then also being able to then prescribe a prescription to patients to be able to go and to buy important nutritious dense food for at the farmer's market or at a grocery store or wherever they get their food. And I think that is really critical as well as that nutrition education that markets provide. At USDA, we have a farmer's market every Friday throughout the summer, and we have a veggie-cation booth where we have nutrition education, and it talks about, you know, how do you pick, let's just say, you know, blueberries. How do you select great blueberries that are going to be ripe and flavorful? But then also, what's the important nutrition aspects of those blueberries? And then finally, of course, what are some recipes that we can use to consume blueberries or any product that is the produce of the week?
I'm glad you mentioned that because that was my next question. I've noticed in a lot of farmers markets lately, they have on-site chefs, they have people to consult, they even have recipe cards. This is what you can make with the vegetables or the fruits that are in season right now. Was that something that was started by the USDA, or is that just something that sort of just evolved naturally?
You know, I don't know. I would say I imagine it evolved naturally. There's so many farmers around the country that are growing really diverse food that we don't always are familiar with. And so to be able to look at something like, let's just say, you know, bok choy or something like that, that perhaps the consumer is not familiar with, and to get a recipe card to understand what they can do with it and the different types of things. I think it evolved over time. And, but yeah, it's really fun to be able to see and to get recipe cards and try out new food that I haven't been able to, you know, have in the past, and I know so many people haven't either.
Well, throughout Central Ohio and all over the Buckeye State, there are farmers markets, not just on the weekend, but during the week as well. Thank you to Jenny Lester Moffitt, the Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
The convention stages for both the Republicans and Democrats have now been torn down, setting the stage for the 2.5-month stretch to the November 5th general election. The Democrats are riding a wave of enthusiasm after their 4 days in the national primetime political spotlight. Vice President Kamala Harris and her running mate, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, officially accepted their nominations at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. A month earlier in Milwaukee, former President Donald Trump and his running mate, Ohio Senator J.D. Vance, accepted the Republican nominations. Now, in a super tight race, both tickets will crisscross the country while focusing on the battleground states, working to win every possible vote ahead of Election Day. Joining me now to break it all down from both sides of the political aisle are Democratic strategist Dale Butland, who served as Ohio Chief of Staff for late Senator John Glenn, and Republican strategist Terry Casey, who has worked in Ohio politics for 5 decades and served on the Franklin County Board of Elections for 14 years. Gentlemen, thanks again for being here, both.
Good to be here.
Appreciate it. Well, Dale, let's talk first about the Democratic National Convention. What is your big takeaway as a Democratic strategist from this convention this year?
Doug, I've been to 6 Democratic National Conventions, and none of them could match the energy and excitement and unity that we saw in this one. And unlike Donald Trump and the Republicans, who got no bounce in the polls out of their convention in Milwaukee, I'll be shocked if polls don't show Harris with a lead now that is outside the margin of error.
And how about for you on the other side when you watch the DNC? What's your big takeaway?
Well, I'll give credit to the Democrats. Their convention, like the Republican, fired up the base. Both bases are excited. The question now, where are the independents at, the swing voters, in the 6 to 7 key pivot battleground states? Ohio's not one of those, but where will things be? And then also, what are the policy specifics? Because hope and joy are not really something you can take to the grocery store or the gas station to pay the bills. So the question is, where are the policy specifics? Hopefully we'll find out more soon.
Yeah, let's talk about that, Dale. My question is, you know, how do the Democrats now capitalize on that surge of enthusiasm going forward over these 72 days?
What gives me real hope is that the Democrats made this convention about what I call the two Fs, freedom and the future. All successful elections are about the future. And that's why Harris's slogan of "We won't go back" is so powerful. Meanwhile, Trump and his MAGA allies revel in their intolerance and seem hopelessly stuck in the past. In Milwaukee, Trump reprised his tired old lounge act in which he called his opponents childish names. He complained about the election 4 years ago that he lost but still claims he won, and also painted America as some kind of dystopian hellscape that can only be fixed, he says, by going back to some mythical past when America was great, but no longer is.
How about for you, Terry?
Well, one of the examples is she did promise to end the housing shortage, but there were no specifics because housing in Central Ohio and across the nation is built when private companies like MI Homes, can they borrow the money at a reasonable rate? Are the supplies available? What are the costs? How do you drive down the costs? So the details, the specifics are important because people want to know more, not just a promise, not platitudes. How are you actually going to accomplish the goals?
So how do the Republicans, though, combat this surge that we've seen since Harris has taken over for Biden and now the bump out of the potential bump out of the DNC?
Well, I think September 10th is going to be one of the key dates because you're going to have a debate with the two candidates. And there's going to be specifics there. There's going to be questions asked. And you've got to do more than just joy and hope. and nice platitudes. You've got to actually have specifics on how you're going to accomplish these things. And also, if you've noticed, the unemployment rate is starting to creep up. There's a lot of questions on some of the economic numbers. Where's the economy headed? So I think the economy is going to continue to be the big issue, and those are going to be the questions. Is she going to keep on doing what Biden has done for the last 3.5 years, or has she got something new?
Yeah, so what does have to be the focus now for 72 days for the Harris-Walz ticket?
Well, unlike Trump, who always makes the election, any election, about himself, I think Harris and Walz have to keep making this election about the voters and how they plan to make their lives and the lives of their families better and easier. And then they need to keep making the contrast with Trump, who not only remains a threat to democracy, but constantly reveals himself as small, petty, and so self-absorbed that the only thing he cares about is himself and his gripes and grievances and plans to exact retribution on his enemies.
For the Republicans, Terry, then, you know, for Vance and for Trump, then, what do they need to focus on?
They need to focus on policy because there was no mention about China. Where's she at on energy, drilling? I mean, she's been on both sides of fracking as an example now. So, again, the policy specifics matter because people are going to vote ultimately, I think, with their wallets. And do they feel things are better, or are we going to have a continuation of what we've had for the past 3 years?
Yeah, ever since the Clinton campaign way back in the 90s when it was, it's the economy, stupid. Is it that again this year when we look at inflation, the high cost of housing, mortgage rates, that sort of thing?
Well, that will certainly be a part of it. But remember, inflation, which, let's all be honest here, okay, in 2020, inflation was down, gas prices were down, because we were in the middle of a global pandemic. Nobody was driving anyplace. No one was going to their job. No one was going to restaurants. No one was buying anything. So, of course, inflation was down. Now it's down to, it got high. Now it's down to 2.9%. So it has fallen. In the meantime, Biden also created 800,000 jobs. 800,000 jobs in 4 years, the highest number of jobs in 4 years of any president in American history.
There was just that revision, though, from labor about the 800,000 overcount.
But here's what was not revised. When Trump left office, he was the first president since Herbert Hoover to leave office with fewer jobs than we had when he came into office.
Terry.
Well, one specific she has given us is that she wants to do a 33% increase in the corporate income tax. We might say, well, that's just rich corporations. But where you work, Doug, does this corporation have money to give you pay increases for the future? Does the pizza shop owner? Does the grocery store owner? So that's just one specific she's given, a 33%
tax. The pizza store owner is not going to be paying an increased corporate tax, Terry. We're talking about major multinational corporations. And please, if you think they're paying enough tax, great. Most people don't.
Well, this would give us one of the highest tax rates in the whole world for corporations. So there's legitimate questions of, she's given one specific, but it's a 33% tax hike that'll impede down to other people.
So pocketbook issues once again for voters.
I think that's what's still most important, and the polls show it.
Let's talk about the big Senate race here, too. The way this is all shaping up with this, you know, Democratic bump and everything since Harris took office. What are you seeing, Terry, in your opinion, the way that's shaping up in this race between Bernie Moreno on the Republican side and longtime incumbent Democrat Sherrod Brown?
Good or bad, Moreno's been slow to get on the TV airwaves, and the warning is have your mute button handy because there's going to be just a huge number of commercials on both sides. And to me, the key summary point and question is Brown is maybe up in most polls 3 or 4% over basically an unknown opponent. How does he sustain it once the TV air wars get evened out and people focus on some of the issues?
And for you, Dale, how do you see this shaping up now coming into this home stretch?
I will be honest. Before Biden dropped out, I thought Trump was going to win Ohio by the same roughly 8-point margin that he did in 16 and 20. Mm-hmm. And if that happened, I thought, because voters don't split their tickets anymore, I thought that would probably be enough to take Sherrod down. However, with Harris now surging, Harris doesn't need to win Ohio, but if she can reduce Trump's winning margin to, say, 3 to 5 points, that might be enough to let Sherrod squeak in, especially since the guy he's running against is no more likable than J.D. Vance. Bernie Moreno steals his workers' wages, while J.D. Vance calls women without kids childless cat people who don't have a future, don't have a stake in this country's future. They both need a personality transplant.
I would agree with Dale that the margin in the presidential in Ohio will be a key factor, but Brown can't escape the fact that I think he's 98 or 99% was aligned with Biden in all of his votes on different kind of things. Even though he's been running commercials to make it sound like he's Trump light, the reality is his voting record is very different.
At least the last two elections for Senator Brown have not matched up with presidential elections. Does that make a big difference in this one?
Say that once more.
I believe the last two elections for Senator Brown did not line up on presidential election years.
Yes, that is correct.
And is that a big different wild card this year?
Yes. Although it didn't used to be. Back in the old days, back when I was working for John Glenn and Howard Metzenbaum, it was commonplace for Ohioans to vote for the candidate of one party for president and a different one for Senate. 1980, great example. Ronald Reagan beats Jimmy Carter in Ohio by 500,000 votes. John Glenn won his reelection by 1.6 million in that same election. That doesn't happen anymore. So that's why if the person running at the top of the ticket on the Republican side, for example, has a huge margin, that oftentimes sinks everyone down ballot in the other party. That's why I say it's not necessary for Harris to win, but if she can shrink Trump's winning margin in Ohio down to 3 to 5 points, I think Sherrod can win.
But in some of those cases that Dale cited in the past, Republican candidates didn't have much in candidates, didn't have much money. So there's going to be, good or bad, lots of money on both sides, tens of millions of dollars in the last 2 months, and we'll see who can better frame the questions and issues and message.
All right. We're going to leave that conversation here.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
We're back now with a legal fight in the Ohio Supreme Court. Both sides are saying this could ultimately sway your vote in November. The group behind the proposed redistricting amendment is challenging the approved ballot language for Issue 1 and its new title. Citizens Not Politicians is accusing Secretary of State Frank LaRose of creating biased and misleading language that's 3 pages long compared to their proposal, which is just 5 bullet points. As of now, here is what will be on your ballot. Issue 1's title will be to create an appointed redistricting commission not elected by or subject to removal by the voters of the state. The group says that title violates Ohio's revised code, which says the ballot title cannot be likely to create prejudice for or against the measure. Citizens Not Politicians also called out several sections of the language that they say are just false. That includes the second bullet in the ballot language that reads in part, quote, establish a new taxpayer-funded commission of appointees required to gerrymander the boundaries of state legislative and congressional districts. We asked LaRose about this language. He calls it fair and accurate. Meanwhile, the spokesperson for Citizens Not Politicians says he's not surprised LaRose passed this language.
Frank LaRose is the gerrymanderer in chief. He voted with the current redistricting commission 7 times to impose gerrymandered maps on the citizens of Ohio. He likes gerrymandering. He wants to keep the system exactly as it is. He has said that publicly.
I deeply disagree with the 7 decisions by the Ohio Supreme Court. And those decisions were all made with a one vote majority. That one vote majority came from a former Republican who's now, I guess, a Democrat. I think it's important for people to know that the system that we have right now that does protect against gerrymandering is going to be removed and replaced with a system that I think is deeply flawed.
We're not going to stand for it. People are fired up, and we're going to pass this thing.
As a reminder, Issue 1 aims to replace the current congressional map-making process and legislative that's made up of 7 lawmakers with a 15-member commission equally divided among Democrats, Republicans, and Independents. No politicians, lobbyists, or political party members will be allowed on the commission. There will also be public meetings for people to weigh in on the maps. Now let's bring back our Republican and Democratic political strategist Terry Casey and Dale Butland. This is the only statewide issue on the ballot this November, and the group behind it says they do have bipartisan support. Terry, starting with you on this issue, what do you think of this debate over the ballot language?
Well, the Supreme Court, I think, will sort it out. I think they'll do a little fine-tuning. The problem is this proposal is 13,000 words, and it is very complex and it is very confusing. And good or bad, unlike last year on the two different abortion-related issues, redistricting is not something that people are talking about at the barbecue and at the kitchen table. And so what's going to decide it is the commercials. And already the yes side has an advantage because they've got about $18 million in TV time already bought from out-of-state secret money. We don't know exactly where it came from. So the yes side's got the advantage because they're going to have the money. We'll see whether the no side can have the money and what will their message be.
What do you make of the battle?
Because the Secretary of State is Ohio's chief elections officer, he's not supposed to be a partisan hack. But Frank LaRose is, and that makes him a disgrace to the office he holds. Last year, he tried to rig not one, but 2 statewide ballot initiatives having to do with a woman's right to choose. Fortunately, Ohioans saw through it, and they overwhelmingly ended Ohio's extremist abortion ban and enshrined the Roe versus Wade standard into our Constitution. This year, Rose is back. And this time, he's trying to confuse voters who only want to end partisan gerrymandering because they know that in a democracy, voters are supposed to be able to choose their politicians, not the other way around. I think voters are a lot smarter than Frank Rose thinks they are, and I think this November they will overwhelmingly vote yes on issue 1.
We'll see what the Supreme Court does, how that ballot language ends up being, and then ultimately how it plays out on November 5th. Gentlemen, thank you both so much for your input today on all of these different topics. I appreciate your time. The deadline to register to vote in Ohio is October 7th.
Every 40 seconds, a child is reported missing. That's 2,000 children every single day. It's a heart-wrenching reality that we can no longer ignore. Find the Children is a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping find missing kids. You can be a part of their mission by donating your unwanted vehicle, running or not. Call 1-800-294-0222. We guarantee that you will receive the maximum tax deduction. We provide fast, free pickup with 24-hour response. Call 1-800-294-0222. Find the Children provides crucial resources to help find missing children and educational materials to teach kids how to recognize and avoid predators. Our recovery programs have a proven track record of reuniting kids with their families. It's time to act. Donate your unwanted or unused car. Help us build a world where every child is safe. Pick up the phone and call 1-800-294-0222. Together, we can bring these kids home safely. This advertisement was paid for in partnership with Cars R Us and Find the Children.
Young people are leaving foster care at the age of 18 with little support and few skills. The National Fund for Foster Children partners with individuals, businesses, churches, and civic groups to provide mentorship, training, and assistance to foster children. Teach a young person a new skill or help them with homework. You don't need to be a foster parent to help a foster child. To find out how you can help, go to fosterchildrenfund.org or contact us on Facebook, National Fund for Foster Children.
In Ohio, a Republican lawmaker is renewing the call to end the death penalty in the state. State Senator Michelle Reynolds says the main reason is her belief in the sanctity of life. And she says the time is right to have that conversation because there have been no executions since Governor Mike DeWine took office.
Republican State Senator Michelle Reynolds says the death penalty should be abolished because she believes life is from the womb to the tomb.
I don't think it necessarily matters if, you know, being pro-life, just when we're talking about babies, I think being pro-life is really about life, period, all life.
Reynolds also says the death penalty does not necessarily mean closure for victims' families.
But there's been a lot of families who have spoke about the death penalty and just saying that because of the appeals and them having to relive and not really getting justice.
Companion bills in the Ohio House and Senate would abolish the death penalty and require life sentences for those convicted of aggravated murder. Just this past June, the Ohio Legislative Black Caucus pushed for them to be passed. The bills have bipartisan support, but have not moved out of committee since being introduced in 2023. Reynolds and House Minority Leader Allison Russo say bipartisan support continues to grow, but believe it could take a long time to make a major policy change on the death penalty.
Based on, I think, what I have seen and the priorities of the majority party in this state, I suspect that this is something that is going to take a number of years.
According to this year's Capital Crimes Report, 119 inmates are sitting on Ohio's death row. The state carried out its last execution in 2018. Governor Mike DeWine has instituted an unofficial moratorium on executions, citing the lack of lethal injection drugs, and has said there will be no executions while he is in office.
Even if it takes a while for us to get this right, I mean, it just seems like there's been this stay and we're in limbo. And I think that that's the closure we need to move this forward.
According to the Death Penalty Information Center, 23 states have no death penalty, including the Midwestern states of Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Minnesota. Washington, Colorado, and Virginia abolished their death penalties within the last 6 years. Reynolds believes it's time to be in this group.
I just think that at this point, we can join other Midwestern states and move forward in this conversation. And I think it's a conversation worth having.
Meantime, some Ohio leaders are pushing to end the unofficial moratorium on the death penalty. The push to restart the death penalty in Ohio is happening in the General Assembly. House Bill 392 is currently in the House Government Oversight Committee. The bill would allow inmates to choose to have lethal injection or nitrogen hypoxia for their executions. If the injection drugs are not available, then nitrogen would be used. Again, Governor DeWine initially paused executions because of the lack of lethal injection drugs.
Again, that's Doug Petcash, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.